had to go about it, write it out and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you. It's the Final Word Cricket Podcast. Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. We are back at Edgbaston. We're at the Commonwealth Games at the moment. First time that women's cricket's been in this tournament. Jeff's been here across the weekend. We've got a lot to get through on the show today. Not only the games that are being played on the field in women's cricket, but the activity off the field as well, with a couple of massive retirements. There's been lots of men's red ball cricket and white ball cricket, from the India-West Indies series to Sri Lanka and Pakistan and England have finished their dreadful run of white ball stuff yesterday. 24 days where just about nothing went right. Hello, Jeff. You've enjoyed being back in Birmingham as well.
I have. 2019, the last time that I was up here for that Ashes Test match, the Steve Smith tons, the Holly stand heaving. It's been pretty full this week, but it's been a little bit more genteel down there and around the ground at Edgbaston.
Yeah, I think that's right. Different dynamic always with women's cricket, women's sport as well, for that matter. We saw the Lionesses have that extraordinary victory last night in the Euros, which I suppose took attention away from what you were doing here at Birmingham.
But just as well, though, last night, because last night was Australia steamrolling Barbados, bowled them out for 64 and then knocked the runs off in eight overs. I was here because they wanted me here to do updates if required. Let's just say that not a lot of updates were required. There was not a lot of interest in what was going on here.
No, yes, the activity at Wimbledon was Wimbledon. That's last month.
Wembley Common. The Wombles of Wembley Common.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing, really, wasn't it? It's hard not to get swept up in all of that. It's kind of as a colleague said to me this morning, it's a bit like how it felt for us at the Women's World Cup final at Lords in 2017, and maybe to an extent the way the Men's World Cup final felt at Lords in 2019, just based on the number of eyeballs that were watching it. There was so much attention. What an opportunity for women's sport in the spotlight like that. I mean, yeah, it's not cricket, but there is a sense of rising tide when it comes to major events like that. And you can hear the hovercraft behind us here that's going onto the pitch ahead of tomorrow's games here, the doubleheader that we'll talk about in a moment. But yeah, hard not to think about what that will do for little girls who are taking in sport for the first time like that, who are dreaming big, and they might find their way to football, but they might find their way to cricket as well, which will only make our game stronger into the future.
Yeah, we've got lawnmowers going, we've got the hovercraft going as well, so that's the background noise. If you're wondering, they might make their way to both cricket and football. Who
exactly
knows? It could be possible to do both, even though football's becoming it's about an 11-month-a-year sport at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it is omnipresent, isn't it, football, and thus it's easier to see how women's football would get into the slipstream like that. But yeah, it was a really big deal, and that may not quite cut through if you're not listening in the UK, but
yeah,
it was a landmark night at Wembley.
I think it was a big deal as well in that it was an England team that went to extra time and didn't go to penalties and didn't stuff it up in penalties. And,
especially against Germany.
Yeah, didn't have that sort of thing hanging over them, you know, managed to find the equaliser within the extra time that was added at the end. So you could tell from the response of the people watching on, even as an outsider, what it meant here.
We should also say that our podcast is brought to you by the Advanced Hair Studio, advancedhairstudio.com/final word. That long chat with Graham Gooch last week was listened to by a lot of people. It was our most listened to episode this year, actually, I believe. So if you haven't as yet, I'm sure you'll get plenty out of it. We got plenty out of it to have someone like that who's been involved in so many things across the game in so many different ways over 50 years. It's an interview we won't forget.
Yeah, and it did get lined up by the sponsors, so we appreciate that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it was nice of Graham Gooch to actually get into the spirit of the interview, you know, be willing to answer the difficult questions as well as the easier ones, and be willing to sit with us for such an extended period of time and do the whole thing properly.
So the Comm Games, we have been putting out daily shows with you and Nat Germanos, so I won't sort of repeat everything that you've talked about there, but taken as a whole, Australia get out of jail against India in a game they never deserved to win from where they were, based on sort of historical markers. It says so much about their depth. I think Dan Bredig made the point that might be the most impressive part about this Australian women's team. Yeah, they beat teams on the reg because they're the best team in the world. But when they do get in trouble, they still win. They find a way.
Well, it's just that any other women's team at 5 for 49 is cooked. Australia's not. They've got the batting to be able to go on with it. They've got the ability to do that. They've got the luxury of bringing in someone like Grace Harris at 7, who has barely got to play before, who's been picked for a lot of T20s where she's had a thanks for coming, don't bat, don't bowl, rained off, all the rest of it, was not picked for a long number of years in there where pretty much any other team in the world would have had her in the 11 every game they played, and then they bring her in and she delivers at the first time of asking. So, yeah, it does look a lot like Australia and then daylight from what I've seen so far. We've had three different days, so we've had two rounds from Group A and one round from Group B, and the Australians look streets ahead.
Yeah, chuffed for Grace Harris. I spent some time with her in Dubai at Fairbreak earlier this year, and, you know, she's quite jovial in the way she goes about things, but she's got a really good head on her shoulders as well, and she knows her journey so far hasn't been a perfect one. She knows that the way she got back into the Australian team last year, it might have been purely almost as a tourist, a glorified tourist at the World Cup, to have a good sort of person around the team and the group with experience. But now getting her opportunity and taking it in the first game alongside Ash Gardner, who, I mean, it's not as though she hasn't got loads of experience. She's won three World Cups. I mean, she's been there a long time, but it still feels like she's a relatively young player in the team. I don't know. I think she might be the next captain. It's a long way from Lanning putting the cue in the rack, but it strikes me that the way she conducts herself on the field, that she might have a lot more to offer as a leader at a latter part in her career.
I think the thing that impresses with Ash Gardner is that often she's given very tangential jobs in this team. Often she's not required. Often it's like, you're going to come in at the end of a 50-over innings for 17 balls and we need you to try to hit them all for six, you know, meaning that she does that team thing. She sacrifices her wicket on occasions trying to play that way. She's there even the way the position she's batting in this T20 team down at six, she's supposed to come in without a lot left to do. So in that situation, they were in trouble. She had to play a mature sort of calm innings and see them through. And so it's like when the bigger ask is made, despite having been given small opportunities, she's able to deliver that.
Yeah, and on the other side of it, the fact that India weren't able to stick the landing, Jemima Rodrigues out of position again, and I mean, you can kind of point to the bowling too, that they couldn't seal the deal from where they were, but in all probability they'll get through to the semi-finals because they pumped Pakistan. Australia did the right thing against Barbados that you referred to before, so they'll make the final four. Other side of the draw, New Zealand, a strong victory against South Africa, who are struggling. I mean, we went into this with Laura Wolvart a couple of weeks ago, a few structural issues there. New Zealand should get through with England, and England performs well in their first game. A little bit of a wobble at one stage, but Alice Capsey made 44. I mean, all the usual suspects doing their thing with the ball. If you're interested in Catherine Brunt, by the way, you should listen to your feed. Look at your feed later in the week. There is an interview coming. But no, like, England are probably still clearly the two seed, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, look, England didn't play convincingly in that Sri Lanka game, but it was on a worn deck and they were chasing under lights, and it's never quite as straightforward as you think it might be. New Zealand looked great, but that's because their plan A worked, and their plan A is Susie Bates and Sophie Devine make all the runs.
Never ride off a champion, Susie Bates.
Yeah,
but the first 50 in years.
Yeah, 91 not she made, and poleaxed them in the end, South Africa. But if an early wicket falls or two early wickets fall, then I can't see New Zealand putting those sort of totals together. They have very poor depth in batting.
Yeah, that's right. And they did make a number of changes, didn't they? I think they had three debutants playing in the Comm games, and I think most teams were looking at trying to avoid that eventuality. So New Zealand, yeah, they need most things to go right, but they'll probably get a semi-final chance at either Australia or India in about a week from now. Jeff, I want to just bounce around a bit here and come back to women's cricket via, I said, like, I don't mean the politics of the game, but a little bit of politics to start, because it has been a big week on that front. And I'll do so via an email that we received this week, Jeff, which I thought was pertinent. And that came from James Dudley. I mean, I'll summarise it. He's effectively saying first-time caller, as it were, and he's enjoyed our work over the journey. But he's trying to make sense of how we talk about the big three.
Okay.
And trying to understand why the allocation of funds towards the big three and the way the game's administered as a whole affects so many other countries around the world. It has a cascading effect through countries that aren't the big three. And I thought that the best example to provide this week was the David Warner UAE T20 competition. Now, story broken, second time I'm name-checking Dan Bredig in 10 minutes, but by Dan Bredig, that Warner apparently was quite interested in playing in the UAE, where all of the clubs, as it is in South Africa, are going to be owned or have ownership involvement from IPL clubs.
Right.
And where that sits for Warner, yes, Australia is a member of the big three, but there's almost that pecking order inside of it. I mean, what's that old Keating quote? If you're not living in Sydney, you're camping out. Well, if you're not playing in India or you're not involved in an IPL franchise in one form or another, you're kind of camping out in world cricket as well. We saw the list of 70 Englishmen who've nominated for the Big Bash League this year.
Right.
And you go through that, and I made a bit of a crude Chip on Twitter saying that there's a great opportunity here for some emerging county players to play in the Big Bash. And the truth is, there probably is, because if you're a high-profile player from the UK with loads of T20 experience, why wouldn't you play in a shorter competition for a lot more money in South Africa or the UAE? Who would be drawn to the Big Bash, maybe for lifestyle reasons, or if you're trying to make your name, like someone like Laurie Evans last year, for example. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're probably not getting Alex Hales, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, that has almost been the way it has been over the last few years as well. You've seen players coming out like James Vince and Joe Clark and these kind of England players who aren't big names on their own.
Well, I think you've got to go a level below to have this conversation. I think they are big.
I think that's where they're
names,
going.
But we're probably going to be, I think, someone like Liam Trebaskis at Durham, for example. Very useful player. I'd be interested if I were a BBL club. He's 21. Mm-hmm. You know, that might be where they invest there and preserve some money. I know they've got a bigger salary cap for marquee players, but that's interesting.
That's not going to mollify, you know, Channel 7 with their demands for star players, because you can't get star players. And so the only way, like you say, is if it's a lifestyle thing for a player who says, I quite fancy spending 2 months living in Australia over the summer instead of England over the winter, and playing a bit less often than a really crowded sort of schedule in other places, and being able to hang out and do some other things and bring my family and have Christmas out there and all that sort of stuff. If that's what someone wants, great. If they want to maximise income and minimise time, then, like you say, why wouldn't they go to a 2-week tournament instead of an 8-week tournament?
And the politics of Warner's, you know, fascinating, to say the least. There were reports through the winter that he was interested in captaining potentially a BBL side. Now, that's not going to happen. They're not going to revert or alter the ban that was issued after the sandpaper scandal in 2018. But maybe that would have helped if they said to Warner, you're going to be captain of the whatever, the Melbourne Renegades. Doesn't matter, really. ABBL club somewhere.
Sure.
That's not happening. Of course, he needs an NOC. In all probability, well, my understanding, talking to someone senior at CA a few weeks ago, was that he's not getting an NOC. So where does that leave them? Duking it out? I mean, probably not. I'd imagine that cooler heads will prevail. But the very fact that this story's gotten out after it's been socialised fairly widely that he won't get an NOC is interesting to me.
Yeah, and that he won't be able to captain, like whether that was something that, whether he's using the UAE thing as a bit of leverage
that you
should be letting me captain a Big Bash side, but then he won't be available to play in a Big Bash side until January. You know, he'll be playing in the test team, presumably.
I think that's okay because of the one day has been called off with South Africa. The suggestion is that the highest profile test players will still play like half the BBL season this year.
Yeah, half. But if you've got your captain coming in the second half of the season to lead the side, that's not exactly ideal.
It's not perfect, but it's still Warner.
Yeah, so it's about where the money is, and for the UAE League or the South Africa League, the money's coming from India, and this was what James was trying to work out. How does the money work in international cricket? Like, why do the big teams not want to play smaller teams because that would still mean getting games on TV and all the rest of it? Basically, in the very short way of explaining it, the way it works is that the home board gets to sell the TV rights all around the world. They own the rights for the matches being beamed out of that country. So if India or England come to Australia, then Cricket Australia get to sell the rights to broadcast those games in India or in England,
which they've done this week,
which is worth a lot of money. Yep. If they are trying to sell the rights to the Sri Lankan market or the South African market or the Bangladesh market, there's not much money in it. So that's the short version, is that the smaller teams bring less money in when they visit because those rights are less lucrative to sell. A home broadcaster will broadcast whatever, you know, Sri Lanka can show up, Zimbabwe, whatever. It'll still be on, like the Australian summer will still be on Australian screens, and it's still included in the same deal, but the sale value of what you can sell overseas is much less.
Yeah, and CA in their annual report account for this as well. So they have a 4-year sort of budget cycle, if you like, where 2 of the years they make a hefty profit, Ashes England, and that's reflected in the FTP, well, at least what we know of the FTP that's coming out soon for the next 6 years. And the other years they actually make a loss on the home summer because of what you're describing there. Well, maybe not a loss, but they don't make anywhere near it.
Often they do make
a loss. Yeah.
Because there isn't a lucrative deal to sell, to beam the games back to the Caribbean or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so that's why just about every country in the world relies on India touring them, because when India visits, then they own the rights to sell that broadcast vision back to India.
Which India knows. And to the
USA, where a lot of Indian expats live and watch cricket.
There was a massive deal done last week between Cricket Australia and their rights to the Indian market, to a domestic television provider there. They've actually changed from Sony to Star, so there's a shifting sands there. But that's big money compared to what they've got in previous rights cycles, and that's all to do with how popular Australian cricket, international cricket, is in the subcontinent, is in India primarily. So
Indian audiences love watching India play Australia. You know, that's a big draw card one.
Sure.
And increasingly so, India's become a big ticket item in Australia because that rivalry is built up.
And Bharat made this point recently, I think, when talking to you, Jeff, that India have been pretty good global citizens on travelling, right? Certainly through the pandemic, and they do get around and discharge their bilateral commitments. They haven't been reluctant tourists or anything like that. I mean, they're playing Zimbabwe in a month or so from now, if I recall correctly. I mean, not many countries are going out of their way to visit Zimbabwe.
No, they certainly play Zimbabwe and Bangladesh and so on much more than elsewhere. Yeah. It's not entirely altruistic, of course, because that means that India tends to get the votes of those boards at the ICC when they want to get something passed. They have those teams, those countries in their pocket effectively.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, like, it's not as though the BCCI aren't wise to this. They know they hold the cards when it comes to how important these tours are from overseas. So, there's been a lot said and written about this in the last few weeks, and it's fairly complicated terrain, but it's a conversation that we're going to keep having, James. So thanks for your note. And, someone said to me this week, I won't say who, when I was having a conversation about the future of cricket and how kind of depressing 2022 has been so far in many ways. And they said to me that it's a little bit like climate change. You think you've got plenty of time to fix it, but maybe it's too late already. And 2022 might be that for cricket.
Yeah.
We might look back in 10 years' time and say, we're trying to sort of unscramble the egg, but it was already, the omelette was being made well before, and 2022 was a year where,
we were sandbagging the ocean, not the river.
There you go. So a fairly grim way to start the show, but so it is. And there is a relationship here between the men's game and the women's game. I think that Hypercourse made this point on Twitter this morning, the great women's cricket statistician, that we felt a little bit inoculated from this in women's cricket because almost always the best team is showing up. Injuries, whatever, but occasionally availability. But it's never a question as to whether you play for your country or domestic cricket. That wasn't the sort of decision that women were being asked to make.
Well, there wasn't much domestic cricket available that was attractive.
But when there was, they were picking countries, my point. You weren't seeing players when you go back to the early BBL days when the South Africans and the Indians got to the end of their season. They would play for their country. They wouldn't get NOCs to stay. And, countries were firm about that. Now, we've had two retirements in quick succession from two women who are still very much at the peak of their powers. They are different cases, and we'll go into both, because there are some subtleties involved with Lizelle Lee, which have become apparent in the last week with an excellent interview she did on the BBC Stumped podcast with Ali Mitchell. And Deandra Dotton, bombshell. You were only watching her play yesterday for Barbados.
Yeah.
And she's released a statement on iPhone Notes, which is the way these days.
Sure.
It was dated 1 July. I think she probably meant to write 1 August because she played during July. But anyway,
31 July,
let's ignore that. But the point is, with Lizelle Lee, they're, as we expected, we were a little bit wrong with how we framed our chat the other week. We were reading between the lines. We thought it might have been all about her want to play domestic cricket. Well, it turns out that she did want to do both, but there was resistance inside the South African setup to do with basically her weight.
They had ruled that she was not meeting fitness standards, and that essentially it was held up as a deal, right? If you want to go and play in the 100, you won't get the certificate. So an NOC is a no objection certificate, if you don't know the lingo, that a home board has to give to a contracted player to allow them to go and play anywhere else, to go and play in a domestic league in another country, something like that. So Cricket South Africa had said to her, unless you lose a certain amount of weight and fit into these standards that we want, we won't give you the NOC, so we'll block you from playing in the 100, which means we'll block you from earning a bunch of money, a lot more than Cricket South Africa can pay for a yearly salary for their female players. We'll stop you from playing in the 100 unless you can comply with this direction.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on here. So one of the parts of this interview is that Lizelle has got a young family, recently had a child with her partner, so thus there's this kind of financial imperative, right? And there is a multi-speed economy in women's cricket. There's the money you can get from being an Australian cricketer or an English cricketer, and increasingly in Indian cricketer too. And then there's the money you get if you're not playing in one of those nations.
Sure.
So that's the first thing to consider. So, being on the top line of rankings for the 100 or the second top line means quite a bit as a woman yep. relative to what you can make in a 12-month cycle.
She's later into her career anyway. She probably doesn't have 30s, a lot of yep. years left. Therefore, it's like she has to earn what she can while she can.
Yeah, and there's other bits here too. So she wasn't actually able to have her weight taken initially, at least when she was at home. So they took a reading. The next day they took a skinfold reading, and she didn't get her weight taken on that second day when it was being monitored because she felt anxious about her weight having fluctuated up overnight. And what if one reading was inconsistent with the other? So she didn't, which was within her rights to do so. And the next time she had her weight taken, it was much higher than the first reading. So there were these different numbers floating around, who was measuring it, what was fair game to mm-hmm. do on your own, and all that kind of thing. It meant that Hilton Marine, the coach of the South African team, he was quite evasive when first asked about it. The suggestion now is that they were intentionally not trying to draw attention to the fact that it was to do with her weight. They were trying to be sensitive to that. But, I mean, at what cost? All it meant was that there was a number of weeks of speculation until Lizelle got to tell her own story.
Yeah, but, I mean, and this is a highly complicated thing when watching and assessing women's sport, is that because there's so much this kind of overwhelming pressure on women about body image, weight, and all the rest of it, this insane focus on something which isn't necessarily a measure of good health or bad health. It can be, but it's not always. That whenever it's talked about, it's easy to say, well, you should just talk about it bluntly and neutrally like you would anything else, or like you would with men or whatever. It's not the same as with men, because it doesn't come with hundreds of years of social baggage. It doesn't come with all of the loading, all of the inference that is attached to certain words, to certain descriptions, to the way that women are assessed and commodified and objectified rather than treated as the individuals and the athletes that they are. It just doesn't have the same baggage that comes along with it as it does when talking about men's sport. You know, some of that comes into it in men's sport, but it is inherently a different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that weight was used as the reason for her not getting picked in Ireland recently and for this series in England, that was the risk that she was going to be dropped again. Lizelle saying that she didn't receive support from CSA to lose weight. I mean, even something as simple as that.
Sure.
And all of what you're referring to there about the historical baggage around the way women who are seen to be overweight are described and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. It is sensitive. But I think that by leaving that vacuum, if you like, they didn't help themselves. That they would have... They shouldn't have put her in a situation where she had to go out and do the big tell-all interview. This could have been handled in a better way than it was. And and there's another part to this, is that the other fitness tests that she has to do, according to the interview, she was fine with them. I assume that's like bleep tests and other bits and bobs, running tests. Yep. So from her perspective, her cricket fitness, her batting fitness was still sufficient to play at the top level. And I mean, I know she's had a poor year in one-day cricket in 2022, but it's only 12 months ago that she was ranked number one in the world. So you're allowed to have a bad year or whatever and still be picked in the team. So form is a small part of this, but you can't tell me that she isn't playing in the Commonwealth Games if she's available to be selected. Of course she is.
Right. And the way that, say, South Africa bombed in a run chase the other day against New Zealand, where their two openers came out, got stifled, got suffocated, poked the ball around, couldn't score it better than a runner ball. You know, I mean, Lizelle, she's the kind of player who might be caught at cover for two, but she's also the kind of player who might get you 60 off 35.
Or genuine match winner.
Turbocharge that kind of run chase.
And it's remained so as well. So it's not as though, there is a form thing, 80-odd runs in 8 games this year or something, but it's deeper than that. And credit to Ali Mitchell for getting the interview and to Lizelle Lee for being willing to tell her story, because let's hope there's a way through this as well, I should add. I mean, I know she's currently retired, but it's not without precedent for athletes to come out of retirement, and I hope that there is some middle ground where she can get the NOC she requires. That's the other thing, by the way. I hope she gets the NOC, because South Africa could deny her that.
But a board still has control over an athlete, I think, up to 2 years they've retired under ICC rules, you know, probably to avoid this kind of thing of saying, well, I'll just get out from underneath the obligations of the umbrella and then come back later.
And so it goes for DeAndre Dalton. Now, this was even more surprising. You know, playing yesterday for Barbados, 31 years of age, still very much in the middle of her career. I saw her dominate games at the fair break only a few months ago, and she had that wonderful run before the World Cup this year where she made a truckload of runs against South Africa and against New Zealand, and now has found herself making this decision. And it is a very strongly worded statement by athlete standards. She says here that She's going to play domestic cricket, but she's done after 14 years as a West Indies player. There have been many obstacles in my cricketing career. However, the current climate and team environment has been non-conducive to my ability to thrive and reignite my passion. She later says this is stronger again. I realise I'm no longer able to adhere to team culture and team environment as it's undermined my ability to perform excellently. I mean, there's clearly something going on in the dressing room, right? But again, whatever's going on in the dressing room, she's retiring in the middle of the Commonwealth Games at 31, an outstanding cricketer, crucial to their fortunes as a West Indies women's side.
Yep.
She'll need to get an NOC as well. Now, the bit going on there.
Well, quite a bit going on there. And it's notable, yes, it's in the middle of the Commonwealth Games, but she's playing for Barbados here, not playing for West Indies, which is interesting as well. So her last West Indies turnout would have been in the 50-over World Cup.
Yep.
In some ways, I think maybe she's just tired. I mean, she's been pretty much carrying this team for a long time. She's, you know, she was the first kind of genuine superstar in that West Indies lineup. She's so often been the one that they rely on more than anybody else, bat, ball, field, whatever it is. You could never say that she's someone who hasn't put in. Like, remember her breaking her face in the Big Bash fielding, you know, so desperate to try to stop a boundary that she smashed her head into the ground. I mean, you know, horrific injury, came back from that as soon as she could, kept playing. So in some ways I kind of understand that maybe there are things that are difficult at the moment which she would have pushed through previously, but at this point she's saying, fuck it, you know, I've been doing this for long enough, it's time to give up.
Yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. But yeah, it just seems odd to me that she's going to keep playing domestic cricket. So it's not really a workload thing. It's a West Indies team thing, right? So whether that's she's fallen out with somebody, sounds like she might have. Mm-hmm. Is that the way that Cricket West Indies are treating her or perceived to be treating her?
It didn't sound like a board problem.
Feels more like a dressing room thing, doesn't it?
It sounded like an 11 problem. But why has the 11 problem come to the fore during the Barbados
Well, you can draw your own conclusions.
Yeah.
There are players in that West... Well, a number of senior players from the West Indies team who are playing with DeAndre here.
Yeah, so they're probably five there. You know, Hayley Matthews is there.
Yep.
The Knight sisters, Shamelia Connell, Shakira Selman, sort of off the top of my head, are the principal West Indies players who are in this team. But, I mean, the Barbados team looked pretty cheerful in their first game against Pakistan. They seemed to be having a pretty good time out there when they were bowling to the Pakistanis. So, and in some ways they looked more animated and more into it than the West Indies team sometimes does. You know, sometimes that West Indies side can look pretty diffident when they're out there on the field. So I didn't read anything in the body language that suggested there was a problem. She's been opening the batting with Hayley Matthews. I mean, you know, when Hayley Matthews got out against Australia last night, she was walking off bashing her bat into her pad like she was really annoyed. It wasn't like, I don't care, you know.
Sure.
That didn't seem to be the way the body language was going. So, yeah, what is it that's... Or did she write this on the 1st of July? Has she known this for a while and only just put it out?
Yeah, that's a good point. Was this something that was always on the cards? I suppose we'll find out soon. By numbers, 126 T20 internationals, over 2,500 runs, a couple of tons, including the fastest ever, a 38 baller in 2010 against South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
She played 143 one-day internationals for nearly 4,000 runs at 30, including three centuries. So this year, Mithali Raj, Anya Shrubsole, Mignon Dupriya, Catherine Brunt in Test cricket,
Julan Goswami,
Lizelle Lee, Amy Satterthwaite have all left the international stage, which... I mean, that happens often after a 50-over World Cup, but that's a pretty big transition. I mean, they would be the crux of more or less a World 11. Well, at least all of the names on that page at one point or another have been near enough to the top of the rankings. So there is a lot happening behind the scenes in women's cricket right now, acknowledging that Satterthwaite wasn't ready to retire either.
And Leah Tuhu, her wife, got cut by New Zealand cricket, and then they had to come crawling back and ask her to come back to the team because... they were short on fast bowlers and realised that they'd made a mistake.
So let's leave women's cricket there just for now. But I did sort of flag this up and I might as well tell you. Catherine Brunt will be joining the final word when we go and visit her later today. So that'll be in your feed either tomorrow or the day after when you're listening to that. Catherine Brunt, the great England fast bowler. Jeff, time for, as we watch some training behind us. Who's training behind
New Zealand.
Us?
Which team?
New Zealand behind us here. Yep. Let's do a little bit of Nerd Pledge. Why don't you tell the world about that?
A bit of... Nerd Pledge!
I wonder what they'll think of that.
What will they think of that?
And then we'll have a break and then we'll do some men's cricket. The number today is Ed Henty 206. The clue for you, Jeff. Nerd Pledge is a young Tassie boy's trip to Belrive to see the local hero, which ended up two disappointing and the number two before the disappointing.
Two disappointing. Yeah, I'm not sure if I factored that into my reply. But so, Ed, let's look at it this way. I haven't, strictly speaking, solved this, but I'm looking for a trip to Bellerive that ended up being disappointing. There are quite a few of these in terms of a local hero. So David Boone twice made ducks in the third innings of a test match at Bellerive, made a first bowler against Sri Lanka in 89.
Which was the first test there.
What was Sri Lanka's first visit to Australia?
I think Booney getting a duck at Bellerive was a pretty big deal then.
Yep. He made some runs in the first innings, but not in the second. 11 ball duck against Pakistan in 1995, David Boone, but Australia won both of those easily. Obviously, Ricky Ponting played quite a few test matches there. While Australia thrashed the West Indies in 2005, he made 17 in the first innings and not out in the second. So I thought that could have been disappointing because they needed about 76 to win, but the openers put on most of them.
Right.
A wicket falls right at the end. Ponting comes out and doesn't even get the chance to score. 206. I was like, okay, he batted for 2 minutes and hit zero sixes. 206. I doubt it.
Probably
I strongly
not.
Doubt
yep.
it. Although the two in the clue could have been the 2 minutes that he batted.
Yep.
Who knows? He also played in that game that Australia lost to New Zealand in 2012, the Doug Bracewell match. Ponting makes 5 and 16, disappointing. Now, I knew that Doug Bracewell took 6 for 40 that day because we've talked about it on the show before. He didn't get a wicket in his first spell, so I thought, hang on, did he take the 6 for 20 when he got on a roll? Almost, 6 for 26. Bugger. That would have been a good one in terms of being able to close that out. So the last option, I think, is 2012. That's the last time a Tasmanian played a test match at Bellerive. Ben Hilfenhaus played against Sri Lanka. Disappointing. Bloody oath, disappointing. He gets recalled to the test team after South Africa towel up Australia over at the Wacker. They whack Mitchell Starc and Mitchell Johnson around. And so Ben Hilfenhaus gets brought back for control, right? A home game, Tasmanian bowler, here we go. Everybody's happy. He gets Dimuth Karunaratne out, caught behind. It's his 99th test wicket. He's going to bring up the 100. And then he gets injured.
Yeah.
Side strain after 12.2 overs. Shane Watson has to be the Ashwell Prince and finish off the over for him. And Ben Hilfenhaus doesn't bowl again in the test, doesn't bowl in the second innings, doesn't bowl again for Australia in his career. That was it. That was his last test outing for Australia. So how do I link it for 206, though? Because there's not a lot going on for 206. Ben Hilfenhaus faced 206 balls in List A cricket in his career. I don't think that's good enough. But the one thing that could make it work is this, right? The reason he got recalled back to the team when Starc and Johnson got belted around in that Wacker test match, South Africa out cheaply on day one, Australia out cheaply by tee on day two. And in the last session of that day with Australia bowling to South Africa, they got batted around for 206 runs.
Ah.
And that was the reason that Ben Hilfenhaus got recalled to the test team for that fateful innings that ended in the side strain and ended his career on 99 test wickets. Could it be that?
I was disappointed by that, watching it on telly. That was Ricky Ponting's final test match at Perth as well. And Hashim Amla missed the opportunity by one run to bring up a century in a session at the Wacker. And all of the other centuries in a session at the Wacker. So, let me get this right. Doug Walters, 74-75. Adam Gilchrist, 2006-07. And David Warner, which was 2012-13. All happened at Perth in the final session. I'm like, oh, this is too good. Could be a fourth here. And Amla, I think he faced the last two balls of the day on 99 and didn't get a single. So missed out, brought up the 100 the next day.
Hash.
And he did get back to the squad, Hilf, by the way. He on 99 wickets, they took him to South Africa in 13-14 for that what proved to be successful series. But the only game he played on tour was the dodgy tour game against themselves, where I think that was the first time Grant Baldwin, who would go on to field for Australia in a test match, the assistant manager and physiotherapist in the team. He first played in that game to make up the numbers. And yes, Ben Hilfenhaus didn't feature in the test matches. Instead, they brought back Paddo for the finale.
Yes.
Yes, and yes, misses out on 99. We mentioned Billy Brownless on 199 games or whatever it was, 198 games a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So it is for the big German disco, Ben Hilfenhaus.
Yep. Sad times. But, you know, not everyone gets 99 test wickets.
Patreon.com/thefinalword if you want to contribute to our A, Patreon page, B, Nerd Pledge list, C, be part of story time, and D, most important of all, join the Discord channel. It is glorious on there. We often say it's the happiest place in the cricket internet, and I mean it. And what do you know? We actually just recorded Storytime 100. spoiler, we're doing that first and we're doing this second, one of those weeks. And we had a bit of a live audience there, as we mentioned on Storytime last week. We had a number of our patrons and Discord members join us on Zoom for that, and it was absolutely beautiful. So make sure you tune in to a special edition of Storytime this weekend.
Yep, send us a number and be part of the fun.
Right, we're going to take a break on The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon. When we return, we'll be talking about men's cricket around the world, especially England. Jeff, before getting on with the show, today's episode is brought to you by Woodstock Cricket, woodstockcricket.co.uk, TFW20 for your 20% off. And why wouldn't you? You've now seen the Tour de Force. You've seen my cricket bat, and it is a Tour de Force.
Picked it up.
Just what it says on the tin.
Yep.
Is that the biggest bat? I mean, in terms of the thickness of the edges,
yeah.
it's a very big piece of wood.
You can just about turn it sideways and bat with it. It might be good to do that for practice. I don't know if you want to really make sure you're middling your drives. But it is compulsory when you see someone else's cricket bat to then pick it up and then have a couple of little air swings and then nod at them and then say,
looks good.
Good pickup.
That's what it does too. It's only, I think it's a 2.9 or a 2.10. It's not that heavy. It's not a Gooch-esque or a Tendulkar-esque 3-pound plus thing. It's heavy in all the right places, and I did get to play with it on Friday out at Wormsley in my the game we played for the Cricket Writers Club. It was my bowling more than my batting that stood out. I hit two balls right out the middle, crunched the second ball I faced straight drive, which the bowler took some pace off, and thus I got down the non-striker's end and had strike for the next over and was undone by a Paul Adams-esque frog in a blender, googly, first ball at the other end and out leg before a ball I was never going to hit. But I did have
right arm or left arm?
Right arm. I just couldn't. I was never going to pick that. It was just over the top of the action. But I did have a net with Vish last week after we recorded the weekly show.
Right.
And yes, believe me when I say it is comfortably the best bat I've ever held. So TFW20 at woodstockcricket.co.uk for your 20% discount. What better time than the middle of summer in the UK or leading into a new season in Australia to get yourself the best bet in the world.
Yep. By the time you get the 20% off, even when they post it to you, it'll still be cheaper than a bat you can get in Australia.
Definitely. Woodstock. This is a good point, this. $1,100 for a bat in Australia now. For shame.
Wow.
For shame.
You buy a secondhand car for that.
For shame. $1,100. Give me a spell. Buy a Woodstock. Much, much cheaper than that, even after the 20%. That really does help knock the price around and sorts out your delivery and all the rest of it. Woodstockcricket.co. UK. That came out well. TFW20 is the code. Let's get on with the show.
Hi, I'm Brian Roddle. You're listening to The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins.
Final Word, Adam Collins, Jeff Lemon here at Birmingham Edgbaston, where we're seeing some range hitting. We just had our first heads, which we had Laura Vulvart, as you would have seen on YouTube, taking cover when we were recording the interview with her last week. Thankfully, the range hitting is going out towards the Holly Stand, where I can see I can see Susie Bates at long on, actually. The ball's just gone over her head into the stand.
Divine batting? Looks like
I think it might be. Yes, that being the case, even though we're on the third deck,
could get up
a very wide long off, it could still get up here. So that'll scare me. That's a great catch by Susie Bates. Bulleted to her down there. Hey, let's. England have got a problem. We need to talk about.
She's got the gloves on, Susie Bates. She's got the little like full forward, little like Tony Modra.
You see the Australian team wearing these, and the England team. Often we're watching them train more than others in the slips before playing so they don't hurt their palm. I want some. When I'm at cricket training, which I rarely am these days, but it's always a factor. It's always a, you don't really want to take too many balls at training and risk breaking a finger or whatever. Those gloves definitely, at least psychologically,
that's
make a difference.
That's why I avoid taking catches. Having to field in places where I might have to take a catch.
Let's talk about England. They were absolutely annihilated in the third T20 yesterday by 90 runs to the Proteas in a game they built up as quite an important one. They hadn't won a trophy across the 24 days. It's crazy that the white ball summer was condensed into 24 days, but they played 12 matches. They lost both the T20s and the one days against India 2-1. They drew the one day series against South Africa 1-1 due to a washout, and they lost the T20s 2-1. I mean, this is the world champion in the 50 over format. It's the side that probably should have been in the final of the T20 World Cup last year on the basis of form and didn't quite get there when they were knocked off by New Zealand, but still a fantastic team over about a 6 or 7 year period now. They've lost their captain and they've seemingly lost their intent. I mean, they can from time to time pull it off, but making bulk runs in a hurry, which was their calling card, seems to have lost them for now.
Well, yeah, you put it into the... It's like, do you put it in the camp of the don't write off a champion, or do you put it into the camp of they've started falling apart and haven't done the planning that they need to do, you know, as to where they're going to go from here? Because it seems to have happened pretty briskly. You know, Jason Roy can't get a run. Johnny Bairstow's doing his best, and he's in a rich vein of form, but he's doing a fair bit of it on his own. Joss Butler hasn't been making runs since he was made captain. You know, they've had... It's not like Owen Morgan was making them any runs in the last couple of years. It's not like they're missing him on that front.
It's true they're not, but I do wonder if they're missing him anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that he's sitting there in the skybox opining on his former team, which is totally cool, by the way. He's been a great commentator already. I can see why they want him there. But, I mean, you know...
Yeah.
Cliched as it is to say, I mean, the Brearley thing with him was real. He even spoke yesterday in the pre-game about the decision-making structure in the England team,
right,
specifically around Jason Roy in the 2017 Champions Trophy. It was a really interesting discussion he was having with Mike Atherton, specifically around when they dropped Roy for 50-over cricket ahead of that semi-final. And Morgan's response was, as far as they're concerned, the captain especially, they wanted to give players as many opportunities to fail as they could, to keep them batting brave, to keep them batting in a risk-laden manner, because they knew that players would stop behaving that way if they thought they'd be dropped after a brief run of form. He described it as you need to let them fail and fail and fail and fail to keep playing the way they wanted them to play for that blueprint that worked in 2019.
Yep.
And Roy was a massive part of that. I mean, he makes his debut just as Morgan takes the team from disaster at the 2015 World Cup into record-breaking territory almost immediately against New Zealand in that series. And with the exception of that semi-final in 2017, he's been a mainstay.
Right.
These matches, 76 runs in 98 balls, and frankly, having watched that third game for The Guardian yesterday, he was even worse than the 17 from 19 that he made. He's desperately short of confidence, and it might have reached that point where he's failed one too many times, considering there's a World Cup around the corner. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but and then the other way I look at this sometimes is it's really easy to couch these kinds of streaks in ways that emphasise the length. So you go, oh, this player hasn't made a score above X since, you know, 2021 or whatever it is. And then you count it back and you go, well, actually, that's 9 games. And it's really easy to fail opening the batting aggressively in 9 times in a row. You know, you can sort of do standard deviation from the mean, you know, statistical analysis kind of stuff. If in cricket, like in test cricket, a really good player fails 3 times out of 4, or maybe 2 times out of 3 if they're absolute gods, you know, more often 4 times out of 5. So it's really easy to get a streak of low results. If you're doing it in white ball cricket, it might be an even higher failure rate than that, because you tend to take more risks with the way that you play. And so if a player is likely to, say, fail 5 times out of 6, well, then it's really easy to fail 10 times in a row, because, you know, if 2 of your successes end up at one end of that streak and your failures end up racking up. So
I think that statistical point's right and well made. I think the issue is that Roy's strike rate's been at about 100 through the stretch.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as though he's batting...
So he's changing the way he plays.
Yeah, he's playing more conservatively because he's mindful of runs.
Right.
Which is fine, by the way. I mean, he's only human, you know, but...
But it's not his job.
But him playing with that... The risk, the loaded risk that Morgan spoke of, that's not what Roy's doing. And it means their power plays have been limp. I mean, yesterday they hit 2 boundaries off the bat in the first 12 overs of their chase. 2 boundaries in 12 overs
T20.
For this England team.
Jesus.
It's barely conceivable.
Yeah.
I mean, by contrast, South Africa, who had didn't hit a boundary between overs 6 and 12 in the middle overs, they were really limping away. They hit 88 in 8 overs to finish, or 87 in 8 overs to finish. And it's Reeva Hendricks, who makes another 50, I think it's his third 50 in a row. Aidan Markram makes a half century. David Miller, the captain in his 100th T20 international, stuck the landing as the finisher. I mean, even though they lost to Cock early and started slowly with David Willey into the team and bowling well, they were able to find the extra gear at the right time, and England were just losing wickets everywhere. It was a bloody disaster.
Right, okay. So, that's the more interesting part. Like, if someone's getting caught at deep mid-wicket for 6 off 3 balls, you kind of, it's easier to go, okay, well, that's all right. That's the way it needs to be. But if someone's getting caught at deep mid-wicket for 6 off 14 balls, then that's not what you need.
And it's the bowling too. Kieran from Cricviz noted that they've gone at 9.64 average economy rate through the six T20s they've played in this stretch. I mean, again, it's a lot of cricket, and I acknowledge that 12 games in 24 days is far from ideal. Yep. But, you know, these are the same teams they're going to be up against in the T20 World Cup in a couple of months' time. Mm-hmm. On the other side of it, you've got young Stubbs, the 21-year-old, who hit... was it 70 from 28 balls or something like that? 72 from 28 balls and hit eight sixes in the first T20 in a losing effort. I already mentioned they've had Hendricks in great nick. They've got Markram back in the team, who gives them an extra bowling option. Took a wicket yesterday. Mm-hmm. Riley Rousseau made 96 not out from 55 balls in their second game, in the first victory they had in the series. Now, Rousseau's an interesting beast. Having returned from kind of being a coal pack, he can thank Brexit for being eligible for South Africa again, but he's making it count. And then Shamsi, who took three for in the second, so got punished in the first game by Bairstow making 90. Moen Ali having a day out, hitting England's fastest T20 50, a 16 baller. In the second game, three for 27. This is Shamsi. And the third game, five for 24. So, you know, they look like a side that were nowhere, Jeff, in the T20 last year, and certainly nowhere in the last 50 over World Cup, who might have found a couple of right ones at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, it can move quickly. You know, we've seen the way South Africa women have just crashed away over the last 3 or 4 months, and maybe the men are on the way up. But I'm not going to throw judgment around on it, but I'll be interested to see if this England thing is a blip that they solve, or whether it's a longer term trend. And also maybe Matthew Mott didn't
poor
jobs at a good time.
I was going to say, poor Matt. I mean, you know, if he's listening, we're not backing you here, Matt. It's just that he's left the gig where he's had the team that wins most in the world to the team that also wins an awful lot, who aren't winning quite so much anymore. There's only naturally going to be some correlation, causation questions that are asked around the traps. But I'm sure he'll be fine. He's made of tough stuff, Matt Mott.
Yeah. It's just, you just wonder. I mean, he probably could have kept that Australian women's job for about 15 more years if he'd wanted it.
Yeah, that's right. Moving over to the Caribbean, where India have been beating the West Indies fairly routinely. They knocked them off 3-0 in Trinidad in the one days, although they weren't thumping them. They won one of the games by 3 runs, another by 2 wickets. They won the third comfortably. There was a Shubman Gill century, which is of note. Shikhar Dhawan in the runs as captain, in absence of Kohli, and Dhawan's been captaining. Well, not in the absence of Kohli. Kohli's not there, but also the fact that Rohit Sharma has not been playing either. Shardul Thakur and Yuzvendra Chahal took 7 wickets each with the ball. So they're in pretty good nick, as they have been in the first T20, where Rohit, back in the team, made runs. Ashwin took wickets. They moved to St. Kitts, then they moved to Florida to finish that series. So I think the last two T20s are on the state side.
Going to drop in and visit Ron DeSantis.
Yes.
See what's going on. What's going on in the Florida courthouse. What laws have you got on the books this week? Who are you putting in the stocks this week, Ron? Also, it's clever of Kohli to find a way to, you know, it's better to make no runs being out of the side than being in it.
You can be more attractive that way.
Yeah. So it looks better on your stat sheets. I can't get my head around that. I mean, I know this has been such a, like, you know, every cricket follower on the internet has talked about it, but he just stopped making runs. How did it happen?
Will he make another international 100?
You know?
Imagine he didn't. I doubt this will play out this way, but if Kohli simply didn't make another 100 for India.
Yeah.
I mean, you were very excited about the 100s, and fair enough.
And I said, I remember talking about this in 2019, and I was like, it is nailed on. Like, there is no way. I'm like, the rate that he scores them, I was like, even if he tapers off a bit, there is no way he won't get there. He has to get there.
Yeah.
He's probably not going to get there.
No. And the same applies for someone like Steve Smith, and where he's kind of, I mean, will Steve Smith make 10,000 test runs? Probably. I mean, probably.
Yeah.
But he might not.
Yeah,
he's at about 8,000 and change at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's possible that Steve Smith might not be quite so productive in 2 years' time, and they do look to move him on. I don't think that'll happen, but the same applies for Kohli. But it could, and you never would have countered such a thing back in 19 when Smith was doing what he was doing, 774 runs in that Ashes, and Kohli, was it 500s in the World Cup or something? Yeah. No, maybe not the World Cup. It was Rohit.
Rohit Sharma made 600 runs in that World Cup.
Yeah, but still, Kohli was a beast through that year throughout.
Yeah. Across formats. So, I don't know. It's an extraordinary thing.
We've seen Sri Lanka finish their test series against Pakistan, and just as it was against Australia, they've bounced back really well in the second test. They made 378 in the first innings. Chandimal continues his brilliant 2022, top scoring with 80.
Andrew Shaheen Afridi has been writing really well about Chandamal the last few weeks, because he's had to go back to the well several times and he's ended up with half a dozen Chandamal.
It's never easy. Like, I think you and I both experienced that time when Smith made so many hundreds. You had to find a new way to write about Steve Smith 100.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously a privilege to do something like that, but it can get hard after a while.
But it's actually like what Fidel's done with it is make the arc work really well, because it's been the he's sort of tracking the progress and he's painting Chandamal as this is the first time in his career when you've known what you're going to get from Chandamal. You've been able to rely on Chandamal, but also that all of the previous iterations of Chandamal, which have been wildly different, super attacking player, super defensive player, he's like all of them have now come together.
Yep.
All of the slides overlap and create one cohesive image now, and he is all of those things at the same time.
Yeah, nicely put. It probably helped that Shaheen Sharafreddy wasn't fit to play, so they had a slightly weakened attack. Pakistan 231 in reply. Forward alarm back into the team for Azhar Ali, who has dropped for the first time in 8 years. Mm-hmm. Didn't make runs though forward, made 24. Ramesh Mendez a fifer. Jayasurya 3 wickets, just keeps taking wickets. And that continued in the second half of the test match. Sri Lanka 360 for 8 declared. Dhananjaya made 109, batting at 7. Karuna Ratna down at 6, made 61. Dick Weller opened.
What doing? Too busy in the pool. Karuna Ratna couldn't get him out of the pool.
What about Dick Weller? Let's let him open. Maybe it was a night. Hawk.
Did he make any?
Nighthawk.
Nighthawk.
You know, 20 or something. Yeah. Pakistan lost by 246.
I always just think, Dick Weller. Ooh, tell me more.
He will tell you more too. Yeah, Pakistan all out 261. They lost by 246. Jayasurya, 5 for 117. So he's gone 12 wickets on debut, then 8 and 8 in his next two. What an incredible start to his career. Good luck to the man. And also, unfortunately for Sri Lankan cricket, they won't be hosting the Asia Cup. That's been moved to the UAE. So I suppose they've not unreasonably had to bite the bullet on that. I think that's a 6-team competition, which includes a qualifier that comes into it in the weeks to come. But that's later this month.
And they were, the people we were speaking to at Sri Lanka Cricket were pretty excited about having it. You know, it was a big deal for them to be hosting that tournament. It was supposed to, bring in a lot of revenue and attention and all the rest of it. So it's yet another casualty of the disastrous situation there.
And Jeff, last topic before we wrap up the show this week or today. There's been a change in the Australian coaching ranks, which you've been keeping an eye on for a little while.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So Sridharan Sriram, who you would have seen knocking around in Net's vision and so on for the last, it's been about 6 years that he's been there working with the Australian team. Now, they initially brought him on under Darren Lehman specifically as a spin consultant. He was supposed to help the spinners and help some of the batters work out how to play spin. And that was his job. And he did a lot of that. He did a lot of working out how to bowl spin things with the wanger, the sidearm. He spent countless hours in the nets. He did a lot of just throwing balls at Steve Smith and the rest of it.
And the Steve O'Keefe day at Pune when he went out in the middle with him and O'Keefe had bowled, three overs, none for 20, and he ends up taking match figures of 12 for 70 after that intervention.
Marnus going out to bowl through the tea break in the test matches in the UAE in 2018, and so I'm sure Sri was out there with him catching and telling him how to get the ball out of his hands and all the rest of it. So it's interesting, right? He comes in under the sort of Lehman, Steve Smith, Pat Howard axis, then survives into the Langer era, and then gets really absorbed amoeba-like by Justin Langer. So under Langer, his stocks rise, he becomes an assistant coach. They use him for a lot of, it's not just for the spin stuff anymore, they use him sort of all round for, as a sounding board and all the rest of it. And then it was very evident that he'd been sidelined drastically under Andrew McDonald. Like, he was just not in the inner sanctum anymore. He didn't go to Pakistan, and that was partly because it was hard for him to get a visa being an Indian national, but, Bharat got one. It was not impossible.
Pretty much the entire TV production got one.
Yeah. So they sort of cited that, but it was more like it would be an effort to get him one, and kind of between the lines it was, well, it wouldn't be worth the effort getting him one. So and maybe he felt that way as well, that it wasn't that maybe the end of the road was coming up and it wasn't worth pushing to be on that tour.
Especially with Dan Vettori then kind of taking up the role.
And they sort of it was pretty evident that McDonald's setup felt like they could do without him, and he didn't feel like he was in a position to push to be there. I don't know. I haven't spoken to him about this, but I'm just speculating here. And then they sent him home early from Sri Lanka. He came over for the white ball stuff. And it's interesting that they mentioned in the release saying that he'd finished up his contract. It was very upbeat. It was like, oh, he's going to pursue new opportunities with the IPL and spend more time with his family and all the rest of it. But it was pretty evident even a few months ago that his contract wasn't going to be renewed.
Right.
He was going to run out the road and they were going to get rid of him after that. They specifically mentioned in the release, they're all white ball players that they talk about, that he had a good relationship. They say he did a lot of work with Zampa, Agar, Maxwell, Stoinis, Swepson, and then Labuschagne's the only one who's kind of a regular test member who they mention in that setup. So he was there for the white ball stuff in Sri Lanka, and then they were like, okay, don't need you, spin consultant, spin specialist, etc., to be here for two test matches in Sri Lanka. You know, you don't need to read between the lines. That's just reading the text at that point, that essentially the McDonald era didn't rate him, and off he's gone.
Yeah, and maybe that goes to their interest in Daniel Vettori, who, as mentioned before, he had that role in Pakistan during the test matches. And who knows what the preference is for the bowlers, who'd have a big say in that. And I suppose the relationships on the circuit as well. Vettori's been around the traps, McDonald's been around the traps. They probably have a longer working relationship, something like that. But yeah, not for nothing. It's worth mentioning.
Yeah, well, just little things, you know, little things that are notable that you pick up in terms of how some of the staff interact with each other and so on. There was much more expressive friendliness from, say, McDonald to other people than there was to Sri. You know, I'm not sure.
All right, the end of another busy week in terms of what we had to get through on. Let's call this part one of the weekly show. I mentioned we've got Catherine Brunt coming up. It'll come out tomorrow or the day after. And Storytime 100 on the weekend. If you want to be involved with what we do, patreon.com/thefinalword to join the Discord page and to help contribute to make the show week in, week out. Thanks to Woodstock Cricket, woodstockcricket.co.uk. Get yourself the best bat in the world at a 20% discount with TFW20 in the offer code. Thank you to everybody who listens to us week in, week out. Our production team at Bad Producer Productions, our editor Dave Collins and Jay Mueller, Astrid Edwards, and all the team there back in Melbourne. And we'll leave it there. I'm Adam Collins, he's Jeff Lemon. We'll do it all again later in the week.
Later, dudes. I had to go about it.